Deep in the North Carolina coastal marshlands, a barefoot girl watches her mother walk away in her only good shoes, carrying a blue suitcase. This pivotal moment in 1952 begins the haunting tale of Kaia Clark, the marsh girl who would captivate millions of readers. One by one, her siblings follow her mother's path away from their dilapidated shack, escaping their father's alcoholic rages. When her beloved brother Jody leaves, he warns her to hide in the marsh if trouble comes. Eventually, even her father disappears, leaving 10-year-old Kaia entirely alone. What would destroy most children somehow forges Kaia into something extraordinary. She survives by collecting mussels to trade at Jumpin's gas and bait for basic supplies. "I have to do life alone," she realizes with precocious clarity. The marsh becomes her teacher, her refuge, her entire world. She attends school for just one humiliating day before retreating permanently to her natural education. While the townspeople regard her with a mixture of fear and disdain, she develops an uncanny ability to navigate the labyrinthine waterways and understand the intricate behaviors of wildlife. Have you ever felt the sting of abandonment? Kaia's pain is particularly heartbreaking as she scans the lane daily for years, waiting faithfully for her mother's return. When a blue envelope with her mother's handwriting finally arrives, her father burns it before she can read it. Only decades later does she learn the cruel truth. Her mother had written asking to retrieve her children, but her father had threatened to harm them if she returned. For Kaia, nature isn't something to visit, it's everything. Provider, protector, and professor. The marsh serves as a living character that nurtures her when humans fail. While the marsh is a space of light, teeming with life, the swamp represents darkness, with water that swallowed the light in its muddy throat, mirroring Kaia's own journey. The natural world becomes her education. She builds a natural history museum in her shack with collected feathers, shells, and insects. Through meticulous observation, she learns life's lessons, like how female fireflies deceive males of other species, insights she'll later apply to human relationships. "Biology sees right and wrong as the same color in different light," she concludes. Her first true connection is with the gulls she feeds daily. "The heart of another is a dark forest," she reflects, "but the gulls were like me." The marsh teaches her survival, treating wounds with salt water and mud, navigating by water patterns and wind. Nature doesn't coddle her, but shapes her into someone strong, observant, and self-sufficient. At 14, Kaia discovers reading, poetry, and first love through Tate Walker. Their relationship starts with exchanged feathers on a stump, a silent communication that suits her cautious nature. Tate teaches her to read, sharing poetry, and promising she'll always have this skill. Their connection bridges Kaia's natural world with human knowledge when Tate brings her a microscope, revealing the Mardi Gras of costumed players in a water droplet. Their bond deepens through shared wonder. However, Tate betrays her, failing to appear for promised July 4th fireworks before leaving for college, abandoning her in her peach chiffon dress. Kaia concludes there is no such thing as love, no one to count on. Years later, Tate returns, recognizing her scientific talent and helping publish her nature drawings. Though reconciliation becomes possible, Kaia struggles with trust and forgiveness. Chase Andrews, the town's golden boy, enters Kaia's life after Tate's departure. Their relationship, beginning at Jumpin's Wharf, mirrors natural mating patterns she studied, though Chase proves predatory rather than protective. Unlike Tate's respectful approach, Chase aggressively pursues physical intimacy, even attempting to force himself on her early on. He employs deceptive mating strategies, promising marriage and a future while keeping her hidden from his social world. The deception unravels when Kaia discovers Chase's engagement to another woman, made worse by learning he wore her shell necklace throughout his other courtship. When he later attempts to assault her in the marsh, she fights back and escapes. Chase's death, falling through the fire tower's open grate, becomes the central mystery, with Kaya as the prime suspect, raising questions about survival when prey turns predator. The discovery of Chase's body launches a murder investigation, revealing the town's prejudices. Despite minimal evidence, only red wool fibers from her hat on his jacket, authorities quickly target that marsh woman. The trial becomes a lens on society's treatment of outsiders. The prosecutor plays to prejudices about Kaya's lifestyle, while her defense attorney confronts this bias head-on. Did we exclude Miss Clark because she was different, or was she different because we excluded her? Kaya views the courtroom as a natural ecosystem, the judge and defense attorney as alpha males, the prosecutor with his flashy ties and broad gestures as a lesser male seeking attention. Even the courthouse cat plays a role, choosing her lap during testimony. Though Kaya's acquittal seems like justice overcoming prejudice, the ending reveals a darker truth. Years after her death, Tate finds Chase's shell necklace hidden beneath her floorboards, confirming her guilt and questioning justice in a system that failed to protect its vulnerable. Throughout the novel, Kaya finds solace in Amanda Hamilton's poetry, whose verses about lonely creatures and wounded birds mirror her own experiences. After Kaya's death, we discover she was Amanda Hamilton herself, using this alter ego to express her deepest pain through poetry. The poems serve as both emotional outlet and prophecy. When Kaya recites "The Night Heron Calls" to a mate or to warn, it foreshadows Chase's dangerous nature. Her later verses about the heart's capacity for unthinkable deeds hint at her potential for revenge. Writing under a pseudonym allowed Kaya to protect her vulnerable self, just as she physically hid in the marsh. Tate's burning of her poems after learning about Chase's murder becomes a final act of preserving her privacy, even in death. Despite the novel's focus on abandonment, Kaya ultimately finds connection through a chosen family. Jumpin and Mabel become surrogate parents, offering practical help and genuine care. Jumpin trades fairly for her muscles and protects her, while Mabel provides motherly guidance about growing up, gifting her first bra and a beautiful dress. The return of Kaya's brother Jody brings partial healing, delivering their mother's paintings of her children and sharing family history that helps Kaya understand her mother's departure. Most importantly, Kaya's relationship with Tate grows from first love to lasting partnership. After her acquittal, they build a life that balances her independence with their connection. "We are married," she tells him, "like the geese, a natural union that aligns with her wild spirit." Their shared life brings Kaya full circle. The abandoned child creates a stable, loving home. Though childless, regular visits from Jody's family fill her shack with the warmth it once lacked.